from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
We live in a critical moment right now. There is, as we speak, a heated debate going on about the nature of American history, and particularly the American founding. Is it something that we should be proud of or something that we should be ashamed of?
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Kathleen O'Toole, Assistant Provost for K-12 Education at Hillsdale College. We talk with Dr. O'Toole this week about the release of the 1776 curriculum from Hillsdale College. Dr. O'Toole, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And we're very excited today to be talking about the release of Hillsdale's 1776 curriculum. We'll tell you right at the front here that you can find it online, k12.hillsdale.edu. Then click on curriculum. You'll see a link for the 1776 curriculum, and we'll give you the address again later on, but that's how to find it. Dr. O'Toole, what is this? What is the 1776 curriculum?
Well, Scott, it's a 2,400-page series of lessons on the American founding and the Civil War for K through 12 students. Our goal with the curriculum is to provide American teachers, students, and homeschooling parents with all of the tools that they need to study the American founding and the Civil War for any grade level, K through 12. You'll find in the curriculum 2,400 pages of resources. That includes primary source documents, advice for teachers before teaching each lesson, a resource guide including books by historians and primary sources that we have vetted and compiled to go along with the curriculum. We've got sample assignments, activities, assessments in there, and some introductory material which talks about the place of the teacher in the classroom and the need for an honest approach to the teaching of American history and civics today.
So why is Hillsdale College K-12 education doing this, making this available for literally anyone and everyone across the country?
Well, we live in a critical moment right now. There is, as we speak, a heated debate going on about the nature of American history and particularly the American founding. Is it something that we should be proud of or something that we should be ashamed of? And that's an important debate because it has to do with the nature of this country that we are in. The founding of the country sets forth principles which animate everything that we have done since. And if those principles are not true, or if the country has failed to live up to those principles in some decisive way, then that calls into question the very goodness of this place in which we live. And so it's urgent, I think, that we equip students and teachers and parents to engage in this debate honestly, and or just evaluate the debate. The tools that they need, luckily, are available. When some controversy over history arises, the way that you resolve the controversy is to look at the history itself. And it turns out there's a lot of evidence about the American founding, a lot of evidence about questions regarding slavery and racism, and the nature of our origins, and also the Civil War. And so what we've done is assemble that evidence, so that students, teachers can investigate for themselves and draw responsible conclusions.
Talking with Dr. Kathleen O'Toole about the rollout of the 1776 curriculum from Hillsdale College. Who is it for? You mentioned for all students K through 12. Is it for parents? Is it for teachers? Is it for entire schools? We've read elsewhere these other sets of curriculum that are being adopted in some places. Is this the sort of thing that could be viewed as an alternative to that, that a school could adopt this for all grade levels if they wanted to?
Certainly they could. We've written it so that it's helpful to a lot of different people involved in education. Our primary audience is teachers. I'm a former school principal. I think that I know what teachers want. And what teachers want is quality, reputable, easy to use resources for planning their lessons. And so we've written it chiefly with teachers in mind.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a teacher of kindergarten or 12th grade or anything in between and you download the curriculum, you will find not a script to read, not a textbook account, but all of the primary source documents, all of the tools, all of the ingredients of a quality history or government lesson for that grade level. And you, the teacher, can then assemble those things and involve those things, incorporate those things into your lesson planning and your plan for the year. So history teachers, this is for you. Government teachers or civics teachers, this is for you. If you are a school or a school district and you're looking for a reputable quality thing that you can adopt to meet state standards or just treat the subject of American history responsibly, this curriculum would be an excellent place to begin, an excellent thing to adopt at that level. And then finally, if you are a parent who is homeschooling your child, either because you always meant to or because you learned during the pandemic that mm-hmm. you could do it at home, these lesson plans are great for you too. They teach you, you know, what are the key terms that students need to know when it comes to each period of American history? What geography should I be teaching my kid? What kind of timeline should they be memorizing so that they, you know, they can situate events in the right order? This is great for homeschooling as well.
So who was involved in developing this curriculum? And I guess in a larger view, larger perspective, why should parents and teachers trust that Hillsdale has it right here?
Well, this curriculum was written by teachers in real classrooms who are currently teaching real students. Through the Barney Charter School Initiative and our work in K-12 education, we work with dozens of classical schools across the country who have been teaching American history and government well for a number of years. We also have a long 175-year history here at the college and a team of professors who teach American history well, deeply, thoughtfully. And this curriculum brings together the work of all of those people into something that is readable, usable, and practical. You know, it has come together over the course of the last year, but it's the product of many decades of work on the part of historians and some of the very best K-12 teachers in the country.
We mentioned the website earlier, k12.hillsdale.edu. Click on curriculum. You'll see a link for the 1776 curriculum there at k12.hillsdale.edu. I think you mentioned earlier there are two units available right now at the website for the 1776 curriculum. What's available now? What's next? And when might those units then be available?
So we've begun with the two things that are first and foremost when we're talking about issues of slavery and the founding. We've begun with a comprehensive unit on the American founding and another one on the Civil War. And we've also put together a series of civics lessons for middle school and high school students. That's not all of American history. So in the coming months, we're putting together and releasing also for free units on colonial America, on the early republic, a unit on the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, a unit on the Great War and the Roaring Twenties, a unit on the Great Depression and the Second World War, and finally a unit on the Cold War and modern America.
It's exciting, it's available now, and it's free for all across the country at k12.hillsdale.edu, k12.hillsdale.edu. Click on curriculum in the upper right-hand corner, and you'll see the link to the 1776 curriculum, in which you then can download and find all the information you will need. k12.hillsdale.edu. Dr. Kathleen O'Toole, Assistant Provost for K-12 Education at Hillsdale College, thanks so much for joining us this week on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with David Harsanyi from National Review about his recent essay, The 1619 Project Comes for the Second Amendment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To get an email every time there's a new episode of this show, head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by David Harsanyi, senior writer at National Review, also author of the upcoming book, Eurotrash, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent, and author of the previous book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun. David, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And it is the gun, the reason we bring you back on the program. You recently wrote a piece over at nationalreview.com. The 1619 Project comes for the Second Amendment, and it's largely a reflection on this new book by Carol Anderson, which is titled The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. What's the argument that this book is making?
Well, she argues that the Second Amendment exists only in the Bill of Rights because it was sort of given to the southern states or tried to incentivize the southern states to participate in forming the Union by allowing them to have gun rights and militia rights as a way of suppressing potential state slave revolts or to keep slaves, which makes no sense, nor does she really offer any kind of contemporaneous evidence that that was the case in her book.
And you did write an entire book about America's history with the gun. Is there anything that you would have, you dug up during the course of that research or can reflect on that would bolster her case in any way? Was the Second Amendment some sort of way to placate slave owners in the South?
There's not any quote that even hints at anything of that nature. And if there were, she would have offered it. But in fact, she doesn't. And she does mislead readers with some quotes from anti-gun activists and, you know, modern anti-gun activists about how James Madison knew that the southern states needed the militia to control the slave population. And that is not untrue. But the slave states had militias. They didn't need the Second Amendment for them. And they had, slave owners had guns. They didn't need the Second Amendment for that. There had been numerous slave revolts before, you know, America was formed. Not just that, I mean, the Second Amendment existed in the sense that numerous states had them, and many of those states had already abolished slavery by that time. In fact, the language taken for the Second Amendment, we think, basically comes from Pennsylvania, where they had largely abolished slavery, as well as Vermont, I think it was, a few years later. So there's just no evidence for it. There is an identitarian sort of revisionism of history going on now where people only see history through the lens of race. Mm-hmm. And I think that leads people to make a big jump when it comes to history and thinking that everyone thought that way all the time as well. And I just quickly add as well that many of the Northerners who were wanted the Bill of Rights and who, signed onto the Constitution were against slavery. So there's just very little evidence to back what she's saying.
Did the Founding Fathers tend to stress or write about the importance of self-defense in regards to Second Amendment discussions?
Absolutely. I think it's fair to say the Second Amendment could have been a little bit clearer. It would have helped us today, but I mean, I think it was very clear to the people at the time. Put it this way, there's not one founder or one person in the founding generation that ever made a claim or argued that an individual should be stripped of their right to have guns. I mean, the militias existed, and in most places it wasn't the town or the government that owned the weaponry, it was the civilians. They brought their own muskets. There is just no evidence anywhere that this was thought of as a collective. The argument over the militias was an argument over who would control them, the mm-hmm. federal government or the state. In my book, I have a whole, you know, slew of quotes about people making the case for the individual right of gun ownership and self-protection, which goes back to Britain. And John Adams, for instance, made those sorts of arguments years before in 1770. When he was defending one of the British soldiers at the, you know, from the Boston Massacre. I mean, he makes that argument. There is just zero evidence that they thought of it in any other way.
David Harsanyi with us. His piece at nationalreview.com, The 1619 Project Comes for the Second Amendment. Civil rights leaders in the 19th and early 20th centuries, how did they write and discuss Second Amendment issues?
Well, they were very pro-Second Amendment. I mean, they saw it as a way of, you know, Frederick Douglass, for instance, saw it as a way of for individuals to defend themselves against people who would strip them of their God-given rights. Even into the 20th century, you had civil rights activists and civil rights heroes making the argument that they wanted to, that not that they were, that they wanted to strip others of certain rights, but they wanted all those rights. As I wrote in the piece, I think if you read this book, The Second, with a little editing here and there, you could make a very good case. That book makes a very good case that the problem with the Second Amendment wasn't that it existed or that it empowered slave owners, but that it stripped the rights of Black Americans and of slaves. If all Black Americans had guns, things would have gone down very differently, probably, especially after the Civil War. Mm. Ida B. Wells and other, there's just a treasure trove of great pro-Second Amendment quotes from civil rights leaders through the years. And, there were entire books written on the subject. There was until very recently. And I quickly would add also that throughout, post-Civil War era and into the 20th century, almost every gun control law was racist in nature, and mostly in the South and occasionally elsewhere, but it was almost always to bar, Black Americans or sometimes Native Americans from having weapons so that they could defend themselves.
David, you sort of sit this book and this argument, The Second, alongside The 1619 Project in the piece. The 1619 Project, of course, argues that America is flawed, has a congenital defect, you might say. Is that what's happening with this argument, too, in regards to the Second Amendment, that they're arguing the Second Amendment is just fatally flawed from its origin?
Yeah. I mean, I think, in essence, The 1619 Project says that America's independence was sought so that they could continue to have slaves. And this says that the Second Amendment exists so that the South could suppress Black Americans and continue to have slavery. Now, again, I don't want to diminish, the nefariousness of slavery at all. And it's true that it existed. It's true that guns were used to make it, let it happen and all of that. I mean, guns are a tool that can be used for evil purposes and good purposes. But the evidence, the historical evidence simply isn't there to say that the Second Amendment is in the Bill of Rights because of slavery. In fact, it doesn't even make sense, as I noted before, if the Second Amendment had been given to all people, there wouldn't be slavery.
David Harsanyi, senior writer at National Review. Find his piece at nationalreview.com. The book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, and the upcoming book, Eurotrash, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. And we look forward to talking about that one with you soon. David Harsanyi, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Up next, we talk with Brad Berzer from Hillsdale's History Department about British Catholic historian Christopher Dawson. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Take a stroll down Memory Lane. At Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage. Whether you're looking for tools from the past, vintage clothing, collectibles, jewelry, or something that just reminds you of the good old days, you can find it at Memory Lane. Those special shabby chic and vintage style items are seen in every nook and cranny. So what are you waiting for? Sure, you can check out their Facebook page, but it's a lot more fun to explore the past and find your treasure. 1665 Pine Street in Reading. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Salato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Reading Electric Utility cares about the whole community, and we offer an income-qualified residential energy discount program that can save you up to $400 a year on your energy bill. And once per year, CARES bill credit up to $300. To find out if your income qualifies you for a residential discount program and CARES program, call 339-7200. That number again is 339-7200.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency child care, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. For information about Hillsdale College, for alumni, for prospective students, or friends of Hillsdale, all can be found at hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Brad Berzer, Professor of History, and Russell Amos Kirk, Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College. Dr. Berzer, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks, Scott. Always glad to be here.
We are discussing today Christopher Dawson. You, in fact, have written a book on Christopher Dawson out a couple of years ago, Sanctifying the World, the Augustinian Life and Mind of Christopher Dawson. We'll talk a little bit about that through our chat today. But for people who are not familiar, tell them, who was Christopher Dawson? Why should we
sure.
know about him?
Yeah, he was a pretty amazing figure. Born in 1889, died in 1970, was regarded in his own day and age that we've largely forgotten him, but he was regarded in the 30s, the 40s, and 50s as the most important Catholic scholar in the English-speaking world. But he wasn't read just by Catholics, but there's no doubt that he had a special niche mm-hmm. with Catholics. And he wrote on everything imaginable. He wrote on economics, which he had degrees in. He wrote on history, he wrote on sociology, but he really, at a time period where academia was becoming much more specialized, Dawson was writing these huge books with huge views, everything from Rome to America. He called himself a meta-historian, not just a historian. Now, that in modern academic lingo, that would put him on the left today. He was definitely not a member of the left. He was deeply conservative. But by meta, he simply meant, if we want to go into history, we have to be poetic about it in the same way that only every once in a while is a great poet born or a great composer. The same thing is true that only every once in a while is a great historian born. He didn't actually consider himself a great historian. In fact, he would have done better had he had a little bit more confidence in himself. He suffered very severely from depression most of his life. So these guys come along, and he thought we were living in a great age because we had T.S. Eliot. So there were certain important figures in our world that really did represent this greatness. But in history, he thought most historians were kind of boring, that they were doing their little academic studies, writing about their little topic and getting narrower and narrower. And he thought that really a historian's job was to try and put together all of this so that we had a kind of universal vision, but never losing sight of the dignity of the individual person. So, but we have to understand that, you know, as I look at you, Scott, you are in some way a manifestation of all that is good and universal. But obviously you're enveloped in this body here in this place in this time. Mm-hmm. That was one of, and much like what T.S. Eliot was arguing in poetry, Dawson was arguing in history.
So how does he come to that point of view that sort of sets him apart from others at that time?
Right. He actually had we could call it, I don't know how to explain it. He thought it was a mystical experience. He was age 20. And he was visiting, and apologize for my Italian here, but he was visiting the Ari Colli, right, the great monument in Rome, and he was standing at the same spot where Edward Gibbons had stood and envisioned his whole book and masterpiece about Rome. And Dawson claims that at that moment, at age 20, he was given a vision by God, and he believed that for one instant, he saw the entire shape of humanity and of human history, and he thought that and he tried to live this out. Maybe he was driven to do this. He thought it was his job in life to write down what he saw in that vision, in that moment. He had one other mystical vision in his life, but that was the first one, and it really did shape everything that he did after that. He had always been religious, deeply born into a high Anglican tradition, had really believed from his mother in the saints and the great heroes of the Christian faith, but had that personal experience that he saw, at least when he was in 1909, when he was 20, that shaped everything he did from there on out.
You mentioned a bit earlier some of those topics that he was thinking and writing on during the early 1900s. Where would you say he had a specialty or a particularly unique set of insights?
He is best remembered for his writings on the medieval period, and in particular, he was always interested in the shape of Western civilization, really of all world civilization, again, much like his friend T.S. Eliot. Mm-hmm. They're doing similar things. And by the way, Scott, I should mention that T.S. Eliot's four quartets were deeply, deeply influenced by Dawson. In fact, one of the four quartets is really a reworking of Dawson's ideas in poetic form, and Eliot was quite open about that. So Dawson had a huge influence on people like C.S. Lewis, T.S. Eliot. He's kind of a historian's historian, kind of like a jazz drummer's drummer,
sure.
Right? You know, there are people who appreciate him because of what he was able to do, and then they take that work elsewhere into their own profession. That was really Dawson. But to get back to your question, Dawson was really, he is best remembered for his works on the medieval period, and in large part, he was very interested in seeing what Christianity did as a philosophy. So he himself was deeply Christian, but he could be very objective about this. What did Christianity do to the philosophy of the classical world? So we have this greatness of Greece, and we have this greatness of Rome, and then all of that falls apart, mm-hmm. and then we have Christianity. Well, do we blame Christianity for the fall, or do we actually praise Christianity for keeping alive the classical spirit? And that was Dawson's perspective, that second one, that really what Christianity did was it answered, it didn't destroy Greece and Rome, it answered the deepest longings of Greece and Rome. And so that's where he's coming from. And he had this great, in one of his books, he says this in a couple of different books that he writes, but he argues that if you had one monastery, it wouldn't matter if you had 100 monasteries and 99 are wiped out. Vikings come in, the Huns, whoever they are, and they just destroy these things. They chase the monks down, they slaughter them. He said it wouldn't matter if, as long as one survived. Because as long as one monastery survives, civilization survives, even if it takes 1,000 years to revive. And I love that, especially in 2020, as we're thinking about all the chaos in the world.
Yeah.
And we need to ask, you know, especially for those of us who are not leftist and we want to preserve, we're conserving things. What do we conserve? You know, are we conserving just old ideas, or are we innovating? And Dawson said there are certain times in history, like Saint Benedict, where you recognize, look, your job is to preserve. You're not innovating. Maybe 1,000 years we can innovate. But right now, you give everything you have to preserving what was there. And that's a great question, I think, for all of us, where we're at. So you think about even the 20th century, you have someone like Christopher Dawson who's preserving. You have someone like T.S. Eliot who's advancing.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool. I think I love that way of thinking about what Western civilization is.
Talking with Dr. Brad Berzer about Christopher Dawson here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You mentioned Eliot. In terms of Dawson's influence, who was reading, who was learning from his writings and taking them farther in the future?
Most important person was definitely Eliot, but I would say C.S. Lewis is a close second. But others in America, Thomas Merton, so one of the great monks one of the great Trappist monks of the 20th century, deeply influenced. In fact, once he read Dawson, he said, "I can never go back." Right? The West will always be sacred to me. French scholars, Jacques Maritain, who taught at Notre Dame for a long time, Etienne Gilson, another French scholar who taught at the University of Toronto, Flannery O'Connor, really almost anybody who was in any way involved in art or poetry or literature in some way was influenced by Dawson. And that I think is, that's what's so shocking that we've forgotten him, because he influenced just so many people. And I don't think we would have in any way the kind of what we might call conservative or Christian humanist culture of the 20th century without Dawson being the kind of quiet gray eminence behind all of this that is shaping it.
Your book, again, is called Sanctifying the World, The Augustinian Life and Mind of Christopher Dawson. People can find it if they're interested in learning more. Dr. Brad Berzer, Professor of History and Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College, talking Christopher Dawson. Dr. Berzer, thanks again for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Up next, we'll hear excerpts from a Hillsdale lecture by Robert Woodson, founding president of the Woodson Center on Conservatism and Race. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Takes flight at Turtle Bay's Wings of Summer Butterfly Exhibit, open June 19th through August 15th. Experience hundreds of butterflies in a tranquil and enclosed garden. Access is free for Turtle Bay members and included with park admission. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide 3 delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Join the Cult 45's Evening on the Green Summer Concert Series. Every Thursday night starting at 8 p.m. at Tiger Field. Through the end of August, enjoy live music with a different band each week. Find the lineup of performers online at ReadingColt45s.com. Tickets are only $5. Come enjoy food, beverages, and dancing at the Colt 45's Evening on the Green Summer Concert Series at Tiger Field at 1000 West Cypress Avenue. See you there!
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Cinerama presents Bruise by the Bridge at Turtle Bay Exploration Park on Friday, August 13th. Join us at the Sundial Bridge for this 21 and over event featuring craft beers, live music, tasty food, and more. Get your tickets today at the Turtle Bay Museum or online at turtlebay.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We hear now excerpts from a lecture by Robert L. Woodson. He's the founding president of the Woodson Center, an organization dedicated to improving low-income neighborhoods, promoting civics education, improving race relations, and developing community leaders. Robert was on campus earlier this year to take part in the Christ Chapel Drummond Lecture Series. His lecture entitled, Conservatism and Race, A Positive Path Forward.
George Bernard Shaw asked a rhetorical question. Must a Christ die in every age to save those that lack imagination? And Einstein said that imagination is more important than knowledge. Ladies and gentlemen, at no other time do we need moral imagination in the defense of this country. As Larry said, I came as a veteran of the civil rights movement, but I must tell you a little bit about my journey. I don't define myself as a conservative. I define my political philosophy as radical pragmatism. And I am a cardiac Christian because Christ burns in my heart. And so therefore, that defines, and so what I do then is look for allies that fits into my mission, and that is to serve the least of God's children. My life is dedicated to serving the least of God's children. The quality of any person's life or a nation is determined by how does it affect the least of God's children. So when I'm looking for political allies, I look for people whose strategic interests are compatible with the strategic interests of the least of God's children. And as a civil rights leader at the time, serving in Westchester, Pennsylvania, the home of Barrett Rustin, who was a principal advisor to King, and they would come through our town to bring the pest in, and we would push our local issues. And I became disenchanted with the civil rights movement as a young worker over two issues. The first one was forced busing for integration. I believed that the opposite of segregation was desegregation, that integration was an individual matter. Because I believe then, as I believe now, that if you say the goal is integration, then you are concluding that anything is all black is all bad. And so that got me in trouble with some people because they said, well, Bob, your position is compatible with the John Birch Society and the Klan. And my response, well, if I like classical music and Hitler does, am I supposed to not like classical music?
More from Robert Woodson from Hillsdale's campus from earlier this year as he talks about 1776 and America's founding.
The radical left has convinced people that the problems facing black America today, 70% out of wedlock birth, the high crime rate, unemployment, all the other deficiencies are as a result of the legacy of slavery and discrimination that followed. And so therefore, it culminated in the 1619 essays in 2019 by the New York Times, headed by Nicole Hannah-Jones, that codified all of that and said America's real birth date is 1619, 1976. and therefore America is incurably racist, that racism is in its DNA, and that white people should be shamed, blamed, and punished, and white people should be, black people should be patronized and paid. And therefore, because the founders, some of the founders were slave owners, and therefore America's capitalism is built on a slavetocracy. And so this is what is pervasive today. And so what we decided at the Woodson Center, because the radical left is using the legacy of slavery, I would say the perversion of that history, as the principal bludgeon to destroy the country, since they were using that messenger, we felt that the messenger should also look like that. So we brought together 26 scholars and activists and to defend 1776 as the real birth date of the country. And so what we were offering, not as a counter debate, we wanted to offer a counter narrative that was both inspirational and aspirational, and therefore to teach the real truth of this country, that yes, America is not, no, none of us should be defined by our birth defects of slavery. How many of you wanted to be defined of the worst things you've ever done as a child? None of you do. Because America is about second chances. America is a country built on the foundation of redemption.
You're listening to excerpts from a lecture at Hillsdale College from Robert L. Woodson, founding president of the Woodson Center. It's titled Conservatism and Race, A Positive Path Forward. Here Woodson talks about what we need to do as Americans.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, my message today is that if we are to retake this country from those who would use race to defame us, we must not do so by having white papers and arguing on Fox against what the other side is doing. We need a ground strategy. A ground strategy like George Whitefield, who was went to Pembroke, 1732 in England. His father was an innkeeper. He died, and so George had to clean the inn where they lived. He didn't have enough money to go to college, and a friend supported him, but they established a friendship. He went on to become a famous preacher, and also did, when he came to this, to the colonies, he did more to unite the colonies than almost anybody. But what George did was he got on horseback and rode to every single colony, spreading the word of God. He must have spoken directly to 70% of all of the people in our colonies, which united us. Ladies and gentlemen, those of us who are servants of God who wish to make a difference, we've got to leave our hallowed halls and go out, as George Whitefield did, and interact directly with people who are suffering a problem. But we also must identify people who exemplify the virtues. What the left is doing now is a parasite on the civil rights legacy.
More from Robert Woodson on Hillsdale's campus earlier this year as he concludes his speech on Conservatism and Race, A Positive Path Forward.
So what our plan is to bring together people across race and class line, the mothers of Appalachia, mothers, Silicon Valley mothers and inner city mothers, to come together to find out how can we exchange strategies to promote healing and overcoming the, and what lessons can we teach those to prevent children from it. But we won't do that as long as we are being separated by race. And so those are the kinds of coalitions that we are seeking to, and we need the Pharaohs and the Josephs to come together. And that's why I'm gonna, what we need, Larry, there needs to be a university. We, as conservatives, we spend too much time doing failure studies. That's why we have the reputation of not caring about poor and black folks. You can learn nothing from studying failure except how to create failure. And so what we are recommending is that scholars go into low-income communities and report on resilience. endless examples of grace in action in our society where people are coming together to help one another. That deep in the DNA of this country is that desire to reward the virtues of our founders. When a homeless man in Boston found $40,000 in a knapsack, and he turned it in, and this was posted, $96,000 in 3 days. There are endless examples, ladies and gentlemen, but we don't have anybody on our side focusing on the promotion of health.
That's Robert L. Woodson, founding president of the Woodson Center, and portions of his lecture, Conservatism and Race, A Positive Path Forward. You can find the entire lecture on Hillsdale's YouTube page. Go to youtube.com, search for Hillsdale, and you'll find the lecture by Robert Woodson. That will do it for this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Kathleen O'Toole, Assistant Provost for K-12 Education at Hillsdale, as we talked about the 1776 curriculum. David Harsanyi from National Review joined us, Brad Berzer from Hillsdale's History Department, and finally Robert L. Woodson, as we heard excerpts from his lecture on Hillsdale's campus from earlier this year. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Just search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Email us your thoughts at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com. Join Sue McClain weekday mornings from 6 to 7 for the Sue McClain News Hour, where you'll hear the up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bach. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, equal opportunity critics. From noon to 3, learn how to get out of debt with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal, local history, North State Now, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune in to Ben Shapiro, your local downtown radio station, KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Hey, Northern California, this is Nigel Skeet. Join me and my friends every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. with the California Adventure District Radio Show, where we talk about all the amazing adventures to be had in our area, from climbing Mount Shasta, hiking the trails, kayaking, overlanding, and camping with Bigfoot. We have it all. California Adventure District. Less people, more adventure. Listen Saturday mornings from 8 to 9 a.m.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
A Moment in History by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. Chinese men began arriving in Shasta County during the Gold Rush in the early 1850s, resulting in the establishment of Chinatowns in the outskirts of almost every town. Chinese were very devout in their religious beliefs. Incense was continuously burned in each house. When a house was entered, prostrations and chanting were made on the floor. A Joss House was located at the Shasta Chinatown, but was considered plain compared to the Joss House at Weaverville. A favorite Chinese rheumatism cure was sold in Chinese stores. It consisted of placing a live rattlesnake in a gallon of meat and malt whiskey for several days. When a patient drank a full shot glass, pain supposedly ceased and comfort soon followed. Want more, Dottie? Go to the Shasta County Historical Society.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
She was of divine stock, not of men, in the forepart a lion, in the hinder a serpent, and in the midst a goat, breathing forth in terrible wise the might of a blazing fire. Homer's Iliad.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Essis, and that only took us 7 tries.
Just about. Our episode today is about the oldest kind of monster. The name is not quite so old, but we are using the term chimera for all of those monsters that are a mix of something.
Chimera tend to be monsters that are half this, half that, or part this, middle part this, end part this, like our quote suggested. But the oldest monster on record, as best we can tell, was the Löwenmensch, which is half man, half lion. I believe it was German. So I think the lion was mountain lion. But it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to try to figure out how to create a monster if you're just taking Lego bits from this one and Lego bits from that one and sort of mashing them together.
And that really is what a chimera is. The term chimera comes from Homer's Iliad. That's kind of the earliest written record of it. But it's just a mix. And the reason why they're considered monsters is because they were seen as unnatural. Because they were a combination of things that should never be together, they should be feared.
Yeah, you see a lot of the mammal mixed with bird, mixed with humanoid, mixed with serpentine in some regard. If you have something that's somewhere between a cat and a dog, okay, that's not as terrifying as something somewhere between a cat and a hunting spider, because they're more separate.
And there's also a little subcategory of a chimera that tend to be riddlers, and we'll talk about the Sphinx a little bit later in this episode. So let's get into examples. One of the most common types of a chimera is a half-human of some kind.
Of course, the first thing that comes to mind is centaurs and fauns. As somebody who grew up reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, fauns were a large part of my imagination. But you also have in Eastern cultures the Tengu, which are a human-bird combination. There are a couple of different names for that, but that's the one that I learned first.
In Western cultures, adopted from Persia, was the manticore, where it's seen as having a human head, the body of a lion, and the tail of either a scorpion or a porcupine.
I think the second's more terrifying.
Uh-huh. Especially in some of the descriptions I was reading, is that it would shoot out the spines from the tail and then regrow them almost instantly.
This needs to be in a movie at some point. You put it in your book, let me know. I want to see this.
Yes. And then, of course, you also have the Egyptian Sphinx, which is the riddler, the very much seen as wise. If you can best it using your mind, then it won't eat you.
And I think Oedipus had a Sphinx in his story as well that was part of the prophecy that would bring about his own doom. But having a character be not only physically powerful, but witty, it's kind of a part of how characters can be better than their readers, in a way. They can be heroic, not only by chopping off Medusa's head, but by figuring out how to see her, by being smart as well. And the Sphinxes tend to be an opportunity in a lot of Mediterranean mythology to showcase your character's brilliance.
the reason why the half-human monsters tend to be so scary is because it's an abomination of something that people are so familiar with. We know what humankind is. We know what it looks like. And if it looks different, especially in ancient cultures, it was to be feared.
And I think a lot of the before DC and Marvel superpower type characters tended to be in this category. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, where he has this, in this case, mental half of him that is animal. And then you've got things like Spider-Man, where you have, he's half spider, half man.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.